Everyone has a community, a neighborhood, school, kids' teams, where you worship, work, work out, or any other place or group where you choose to belong. Communities can provide support when you need it, and even when you don't know you do. Like when it comes to preventing underage drinking and other substance use, community members can be your eyes and ears when you're not with your kids and alert you to signs of potential problems. Learn more at talktheyhearyou.samhsa.org.
You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
All right, so today our guest is Simona Körner. I was going to ask you to teach me how to pronounce your name correctly.
You met it pretty well.
Okay. So we met on the first day of grad school, and we became fast friends. And I wanted to invite Simona because we met up this past weekend in Princeton at a conference called Fantasies of the People. And Nick was also there. And because of that opportunity of you coming to this country, Simona and Nick came from Germany. I thought it would be really nice to be able to spend some time together and then for Simona to be able to share their performance practice and the work they've been doing recently with field recordings with you all. One of the things that I feel really connected with you about with your practice is how research-based it is. And with research, it expands beyond reading, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of research that is about connecting with people. It's very embodied. And in your performance work, you talk about this, right? And you enact it. And I wanted you to come and be able to share that with us.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah.
So interesting because maybe I just... We already talked about that in the car a bit, that I have the feeling I was, like, so in a kind of way anxious to come here and talk about my practice because so much changed in the last weeks, like, politically. Mm-hmm. And not just because of, like, telling or speaking out mm-hmm. about political things, but also because I have the feeling my artistic practice needs to necessarily change through that, or I have to like regain it, and like it's like broken apart in pieces, and now I have to like somehow pick them up again and see how to deal with them or with the forms which are somehow not so applicable anymore. At some points, I mean, at other points, yes. But so I'm really curious about speaking with you today, and also a bit like loaded. That's what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
So maybe I brought some materials.
Yeah.
Like I thought it would be nice because I see my artistic practice very much implicated in like the practice of many others in your practice. That's why we maybe found us the first day, but also like historically embedded like in a network at some point. I brought like a recording of Louis Schulte Sukai, from whom you maybe already heard like the presentation, the video, I don't know, I shared a text, the video of Louis, who was a scholar at my, like, who was a visiting artist scholar at my university in Nuremberg, ADBK Nuremberg, and from whom I learned, like, a lot about sound and perception. And I found it interesting already in our entering round now, like, that it's even not so clear what to talk about when we talk about sound, that it, like, so fast goes to music, that it somehow draws back to the self. You came with recording techniques, and this somehow already reveals so much about the horizon one grew up in without even talking about identity.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to talk about where one specifically comes from, and it tells a lot about class, gender, implicatedness when you talk about how you listen or how you sound and how you perceive this. So Luis, I brought two texts. One by Nisha Ramaya. I don't know how to pronounce her name. Which is one of my favorite poets at the moment, who writes in this book, which is called States of the Body Produced by Love, through reoriginating herself again and again in different forms of narration and through the Sanskrit language as a very sounding language, as language which takes like sound in itself very serious, or like which is implicated much more than like in European or Western languages, where you do not think a lot about like how a word is like in and of itself perceived through its sound. And here we have like a language which I cannot speak, but which she tries to mediate through, which she taught she herself in through reading a colonial book about it, like a colonial lexicon, and she tries to deal with that abstraction of her own life, with that violence, her relation to gain that language as a sound practice. And I
also like,
sure, please, you can watch through everything of this. I brought Simone Weil, The Iliad or the Poem of Force. These two things will also be very present in the text I read, and maybe it's a good, like, giving a short introduction to it is a good thing, because it's like, then you maybe can deal better with a very abstract text I brought. Simone Weil was an organized anti-fascist and Christian mystic, which is like a crazy combination, in like during the Nazi regime in France. And she was like, this text she wrote in 1940 and shortly after the fall of France. So it's really directly connecting with fascism, with the Nazi regime. And she's looking at the Iliad as like the Greece Urmythos, like as the epic, also as one Urmythos of like our lives. And she goes through force as like actually the hero or the main protagonist, instead of like Iliad or Homer or whoever is in all this history embedded. And she really tries to make clear how force operates on our lives, and like through a very layered history. And I thought this is like also connecting to sound a lot, because we with sound we deal like with energy and with like matter moving, stuff like that. Yeah. I brought some stuff from different places, from which also the sounds I will share with you, field recordings, originated, so that you maybe also have like a bit of a material relation to the places. This is like from my forest at the hinterland. I don't know if we burn it, because it's, but you can like give it around and smell a bit at it.
What is it?
It's the resin from
resin
a tree.
From, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Fichte. Sorry, my English. I don't know. Yeah. And I also brought like two microphones, which a partner of mine, a, like collaborator, very close friend, partner, developed, which are electromagnetic microphones, with which I did also record a lot, and with which we can play a bit, like listening to our smartphones, for example, to a bit gain a feeling of different recording techniques, and how actually these recording techniques can guide us through space, for example, and make like our perception can be like a technological perception of our body and guide us in moving through space differently, for example. Yeah, and these are like two things with which you can play them like an instrument, because they're just basically magnets embedded in them.
So one thought we had was to play some of this recording. Yeah. So Simona brought this album, which is from Louis Chude, Soke, and it's the...
Between music and environment was blurred, especially given that audience responses were expected and incorporated into the soundscape along with a native obsession with everything we heard. These effects would begin to define the music, particularly that subgenre of reggae that would become central to my listening, my writing, my research, and my recording. This obsession with echo and reverb clearly spoke to some cultural need. There was something there about the joys of exploring technology via sound, but also about redefining and claiming space. Something about self-expansion and duplication. Echo suggested so much about space and the manipulation of sound and memory, and of course, sounds. It is because of this shared obsession that I eventually named my overall recording and sonic project Echo the Future, the language of space.
The sounds are like from recordings on ground,
right?
Okay. And I don't know if Louis has spoken in the words on ground. I can imagine it would make sense, but I don't know that.
Right. Okay.
Like the other side of the LP is really like, I think, then the singular artists and what they have done. For example, a Kurdish person has been there, who has been voicing in the place very much, and I think it's really according to. You can really see that these sound practices differ from different, like, cultural needs. Also how these persons, it made sense that this Kurdish person engages with voice in that space, for example, others with like a synthesizer. Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting, I don't know, like, how much you already talked about the history of recording techniques, for example, but that, like, one of the first uses before, like, there was radio as a transmitting system, and, like, shortly after the microphone was invented, like, one of the first things was in Europe to put, like, telephone lines from the theaters to households. Mm-hmm. So first it was just the king, but King Louis, I think it was, like, Sonnenkönig. And then it was like a thing that it went into many private households, and you could, like, have an abonnement, pay like 2-3 euros or whatever, to be able to have, like, a direct connection to the theater. So live transmitting was one of the first questions that immediately arrived with like having microphones on a larger scale
for listening
yeah
to the film, the just the audio of the film.
just the audio of the theater play, even before film, you know. And one of the interesting effects has been that the audience is like as loudly transmitted as the as the theater, because these microphones were not very sensitive. So this must have been like, there are written things about the experience of listeners of that time who also enjoyed that a lot, actually, because also theater rooms haven't been as silent as ours right now. That came just with Wagner, this audience relation that you should be silent in a theater.
Did the sound come?
They would also, people would also gather for doing this together, like when one person had this telephone, like there are like a lot of pictures
around.
And it's like a very female thing also. That they would gather as like 5 to 10 persons and sit there on their couches. I mean, obviously Bildungsbürgertum, like bourgeois. But
ladies of leisure.
Exactly. To be on track, what's the new theater piece without going there?
I'm interested in like knowing, you were earlier talking about how sound recording was a part of colonial regimes. I wonder how, like, video and image and documentation for sure, painting, all of that, but sound recording, in what ways do you think? Is that super interesting to hear?
So I also know it just from Louis, so I'm I can just voice recording, actually. Voice and ritual recording was a lot of like ritual music, rhythm recording. It was just like the producing the colonial archive in a large scale. I think this went through all media which have been invented at that time. And Louis also said, like, when he was there, that it was always like when black people started to use, for example, recording techniques, especially with their voice, there was like a huge fear around that, because it was always about the fear of the object striking back, like the colonial subject, which was the object, striking back. And that there's this relation in language that as soon as like colonized people have reached in the colonial frame some state of personhood, white people would try to claim the same state of personhood for a technology, which is insane, because the object relation always changes when the slave or the colonized tries to get out of it. It's crazy, how our language shapes around technology, and also how we talk about AI today. Something what Louis says is like so related to basically using the same language we had with slavery. And connected with the same affect and fears. And just as a brief introduction, I would like, I have two prints of this text I'm going to read after the listening session. It's a bit like, get yourself in a comfortable position. It's like a bit of a thing. It's field recordings I made in the last year. And especially connecting like infrastructures, which I became interested in, which surround like our lives. Through like energy systems, like wind power plants, the electricity transforming thing, like rural education or uneducation, vernacular terms, not very directly, but I don't know, just like relax, try to listen with your whole body. We also realized that the sound really activates the room. Try to listen to the room and what the sound does to this room. So we transport like different spaces in this room. Thank you.
strahlen, to beam radiate, und rauschen, to noise, rush. Begin with sleep. Touch your limbs, feel their skin, but not as yours. Color will come back to the world when you eat, she said. My fingers. I leave out the words now, which shouldn't be in the script, but you can read them. Collapse on me like I love you, but reversed. Sleeping. Through the window, white church tower bright against doom sky. Strahlt in meine Augen. Your eyes hurt from all the scrolling in the night. Thumbs up for someone. Her voice harmonizing with the air siren in Ukraine went viral. IRL, the same sound sirens simultaneously into my bedroom. German E57, 101 decibels on 30 meters. She singing to the possibility of her immediate death in real time. And IRL, the same sound sirens simultaneously into my bedroom. German E57, 101 decibels, on 30 meters, a call for firefighters. Death on the highway. Begin with two sirens. Shh, who has a bird is split horizontally, in two halves. Human torso, lower body, bird. She, who captivates the eye, haunting voice. She who creates the persuasive act, sweet speech. And we know all things that come to pass upon the fruitful earth begin with his body tied down to the masts of the ship, a phallic gesture indeed, fearing the siren's call. His listening has to be repressive. Protect me from what I want, Lord, or face disorientation, cry. To the point of no return, between Greek islands, sharp cliffs. What happens when a space between two things collapses? The poet wonders, the lover explores, the artist needs death as a limit. But you realize that war wants death as horizon, each to everyone, on repeat, try and survive the fucking peace. Begin with sitting in your kitchen. They said the thought of eating came to her when she was tired of tears. White calendar against blue wall, titled Abolition is a Love Language, tells me to begin with March 30, 2018. Great March of Return. Peaceful protests at Gaza border every Friday, 1.5 years, the call for return forms the need to arrive. To be able to move or to move back does not address the past. One can be forcibly displaced, but one cannot be forced to disconnect to what happens when the space between two things collapses. Like I love you. And you can call me Province. My pronouns are a hyper-regional act. She pulsating borders against my skin. Middle class. I feel heterosexual. But when I say heterosexuality, know that I mean the erotics of imbalance. Heterosexuals don't have closets. They just leave their shit strewn about the room, all on display. Hey, hey, I'm speaking to you. Can you address me? A world that seems irreparably out of reach, the poet asks. And you obviously say no, and remember when you read this sentence. We are dispossessed by the knowledge of each other's address, or it's disorienting to know where you are, by Nisha Ramaya. In a meadow, a field polluted, you are polluted, we pollution, and you polluting, looted, looting, a parody of betrayal. Tinnitus. Can you separate sensation from imagination? Begin with a place where time does not hurt, or put your body where your mouth is. Thirst cased down at the edge of her lips. We sleep in a real estate office, spooning and snuggling, simply because it keeps us warm and evacuated from our own fantasy.
Having grown up in this musical household, my dad was a cellist for the Philadelphia Opera Company.
Mm-hmm.
And he would get free tickets for these daytime shows during the week that were part of an education program for the city schools, the public schools in the city, where they would bring kids into the spaces to watch the dress rehearsals.
Mm-hmm.
And because I knew, like, my dad was part of the performance and I could be back in the green room and, like, goofing off
mm-hmm.
after the show, I could also hear all of the performers react to how the kids were behaving in the space,
mm-hmm.
which was so boisterous, and there was talking and there was hooting and hollering and real reactions to funny things that happened, or, like, you know, of course, in tragic opera, there's lots of stuff that happens.
Yeah.
But the kids would react in these, like, visceral, loud, boisterous ways, and the people who were performing in the opera loved it. They were their favorite performances because they were actually getting something from, like, the call and response, right, that we, you know, sort of were listening to at the beginning. Like, they were getting that response that they needed, that energy that they needed.
Yeah.
So there's also something, I don't know, I keep thinking a lot about the vibration being energy
mm-hmm.
as well. And like you said, like, this idea that we're supposed to go into theater and just sit and watch and then leave makes it the opposite of what it used to be.
Yeah, completely.
Right.
Completely.
And much more similar, to sitting with our phones. Even movies, when I was a kid, movies and television, I always watched with other people.
Mm-hmm.
We never were watching TV on our own, and now we're always watching TV on our own. But I don't know how, to Alina's point, like, I don't know how you bridge the gap if it's ever, it's always widening.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sad.
Can you specify the gap, or like the gap between audience and performer?
The gap. And I feel like this is true. I'm more a visual artist, but I feel like this is true with visual art as well. Like, people just want to take a picture and move on, or take a picture and post it and move on. And that idea of sitting with
mm-hmm.
something and having that rest that you were talking about. And really waiting for, I don't know, the listener's high or the viewer's high,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, like a runner gets a runner's high, that people just don't take that time. They don't know how to get over that.
Yeah, and it is a question of time. I mean, we had it in the talk of mm-hmm. Danielle.
Danielle Braithwaite Shirley was talking about that
exactly.
in her practice, and talking about that in so many exhibition spaces where the expectation is to be entertained, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that so many viewers are hoping for this, like, real shift to, like, some kind of feeling. There's, like, expectation. But she creates these interactive installations. I don't know if anyone is familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Danielle Braithwaite Shirley, she works with gaming and creates these interactive gaming spaces that are participatory and involve sound and storytelling.
And she what I also found interesting is that she said a motivation for her to do that was, like, because her audience was so lazy. She mm-hmm. realized that the audience in, like, art spaces is so lazy to perceive, and that that you almost do not get them to that point anymore without a certain frame of
Mm-hmm. And I mean this, and this is, I don't want to advocate for like the White Cube Gallery, who has like some very ephemeral photographies in it, and you should like immerse yourself in that. And this is like a very white bougie understanding. But what we already had with that theater practice, for example, but and also like oratory, like storytelling practices, we had a very, very beautiful artist, guest person at the Academy of Fine Arts Nuremberg, who was invited by Sylvia Kiambi, and whose name I have to look up again, Ogutu. Mm. Ogutu, but I don't know the last name, made a storytelling performance with us with, like, I think it has been Yoruba techniques of storytelling. Mm. Mm. And it was so much call and response in that. And you as the audience, you know, you have been comfortable in the room. And Ogutu was telling a story about like, a colonial story, which then got, like, at some point a massive, great release. And the thing that is happening is that as the audience, you get regularly called. Like, it's like, I think it was like, yeah, yeah, and then the audience answers, yeah, yeah, so that you're with them. Mm. They're just checking in that you're with them. You don't have to participate in the story, nothing. It's just a checking in, are you with me? And then you respond, yes, I'm with you. And this, like, I realized, creates a really intense... Mm. It immerses you in a very different way than immersion in the overwhelming sense of, like, mm-hmm. there's so much in the room that you cannot escape it, mm-hmm. that it just totally captivates you. It's not captivating you. You're very free in that and very in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the voice, the added voices become another texture exactly. in the space as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's another act of disalienation.
Exactly. It's another act of practice of disalienation. Yeah. For moments. Mm-hmm. At least. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think this kind of, I don't know, inability to find joy in concentration or reception or whatever is also kind of helpfully complicating all these discussions around education mm-hmm. and bourgeois education mm. And how it's kind of maybe not necessarily the problem to kind of educate children in that way that they should go to the opera and enjoy, but they're also not educated to enjoy it, but kind of educated to sit silently. But there's also parts of this education is also, and I think seriously about kind of educating them or teaching them or showing them how to enjoy such things, and that it's not necessarily a problem of that, but of the conditions how these kind of education or this kind of enabling of enjoyment is unequally available to mm-hmm. different people, but mm-hmm. it's kind of there's often this, and I think I'm definitely also part of it, this kind of boredom or whatever, or like it's really easy to hate on these kind of modes of education, but I think there are parts of it that are really about finding joy in concentration mm-hmm. that are very necessary for people to kind of enable themselves to mm-hmm. find joy in things that aren't necessarily like easy consumption of stuff that eventually makes oneself sad.
Mm-hmm. How much, though, then, is the artist responsible for doing that education? Right? So if we're not getting that education anymore in our youth because technology is changing and we don't need to have that same kind of focus or concentration, mm-hmm. then how do we as artists, when we're asking for that from people, how much responsibility do we have to be also educators? Or to have that call and response to get them back mm-hmm. in? Or is that just then, device.
Mm-hmm. Does somebody else want to engage in that first?
I think it's a decision that you, as an artist, will have to like make, like develop a practice of making this decision again and again. Because what you're up against is also, like, it's interesting the way that you've been using the word disalienation. Because in my head, sound historically has been a source of disalienation. Because it comes from, I mean, not comes from a position of power, but you know, there is somebody speaking in microphone and the rest listens. Mm-hmm. So history of church, polyphonic sounds, like there's an impact that, and the common man is supposed to listen, the one in power is supposed to speak. So like then you as an artist will have to like really dedicate a practice to it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In order to make people listen.
Yeah.
And it always depends on what artist you are and what you want from your practice, but yeah. I think it's very important to understand ourselves as artists, always as mediators. Like, we cannot get away from this. This is, like, also historically the place we are in, because, like, before art has been established as art. I mean, art has been, like, a life form, you know? It was, like, very socially embedded, and art became art through modernity. And in this, it has always been the education of the colonized and the education of, like, the bourgeois. Like, it has been very much part of the of making and forming white subjectivity as the status quo.
Mm.
Like, in all its forms.
When you say art became art, like, what exactly does that mean?
Like, the term art, you know, is not so old. Like, an artist, you have artists and you have artisans also, like, mm-hmm. in the Middle Ages, medieval, blah, blah, blah. But they have always been, like, in charge of something. They have been, like, working for the church. They have been working, like, always in a very dedicated form, you know, for the king. And then the artist has not just painted paintings, but they also did build the interior. Like, they have always been in this more artisan thing.
Craftspeople.
Yeah, craftspeople problem. Yeah. And with modernity, the artist became like a separate autonomous figure. Like, art should become autonomous from this life embeddedment or implication, because it should be it should be a form of education. This was like the new thing, the new horizon art was directed to, and before it also has been an education, but it has been a very direct education of the senses.
This is rising at the same time as this idea of culture being nationhood.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. Like, it's the building of the subject of the nation state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, art, A-R-T, as a English word, I believe, would be recent. But, I mean, we made art when the first human being of our species put their hand, blood on their hand, on the wall. So,
yeah.
Like, creative expression, I think, or cultural production, I believe, is way more primitive than,
yeah,
like, even researching history of, like, sound. And so, like, we as humans were making sounds on stones.
Exactly.
Before we did, I mean, at a similar time as we did, like, hands on caves.
Yeah.
So when you say, like, it's way too old?
Yeah, but we, as people who are in here and in this program, are working towards ART, as in the English word that is involved in a capitalist system to some degree. We're not just joyfully making things on the side and then going about our peasant lives.
See, that is exactly what my question to Greg yesterday was.
Yeah, no, I know.
Because I believe we're working, like, we're making art, and not ART as in making art for the Western canon art. Like, putting art in the canon of history for the Western civilization. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
I know.
Art is more universal than that. I mean, this sounds very utopian, but I believe in that.
Yeah, probably I would say there comes the question of need in it, because, like, you know, people had a certain need to put their hands on that walls, to leave a trace, to leave, like, they're like very, a lot of needs of origination or stuff like that in these art practices and forms. But yeah, that's why I think a huge question also on that fantasy conference probably is, or leaves us with as artists again and again, is like, is it going to be art what we are producing when we want to like form a liberating practice out of it? Or like, which other form, like, you know, can art stay art? And not in the sense of like, we will do like channeling the creative spirit, which is like the most important thing ever. I think in a human's life, it's super important to have and to establish this and to challenge this, also in terms of education, but not in the art as like the Western program of art. And I get what you mean. I mean, you're on the right side of things, in my opinion.
I hope so. But also, like, what that's I'm getting is that, like, that what the argument here is that art as in... I've lost my terrain of thought. But not the... Like, we're going against the institutional validation of the art when the form of art takes more diverse forms, you know? Like, when it's more diverse than what we have already, like, set as, oh, this is art. Like, massaging somebody with a transducer, which is a work that I recently learned about, and I love it. I'm sure that you've heard of it, like, massage through a transducer.
Yeah.
So, like, that 10, 15 years ago, no, 20, 30 years ago, wouldn't be art, I would say. But now it is. So, like, that, is that the argument, right?
Right. But then also, why did it become art? Why did it become art?
Art with a capital.
Why does art evolve to collect and swallow all these different forms that are then, what, sellable, available in a gallery? Like, what is...
I find your curiosity about education very interesting, because how do you... Yeah.
Yeah. No, I know. But that's why I'm working through it just like you. Right? And it's the question of... And I think maybe, what did Dredd say yesterday in response? It was like, oh, well, you can go somewhere else. You can go to London. Yeah. You can go. And I didn't like that answer. And
it was a little naive,
Yeah, and it didn't seem to really be answering what you were asking. But my question would be, like, to your point of if we're trying to liberate, or if we're trying to mediate and inform or just give some what we have made to others, like, what form does that take? And sometimes I think that that doing that through the institutions reaches more people, and that's okay.
100%.
And then sometimes I think that just handing someone you love something that you created out of your creative spirit is also that too, and I would consider that art. But I also think there's a whole other level which has to do with class. Like you were saying,
capitalism
and taste,
and feeding yourself, you know.
Patronage.
And some people have the means and the time to make work and never sell anything, or never make it to any level where they can get a grant or anything. And some people don't, and so those are different. Like the options for people are different all over the place, all over the globe.
Yeah, it's a question of work that comes in very significantly. It's the question of if we want to go there right now, I think, or I would highly recommend, if you're interested in these questions, to come to Marina Wischmidt.
Marina Wischmidt?
I can write it down for you. You can share it. Who was a theorist who... just recently sadly died. But wrote a lot about these infrastructural questions and
like around the question of how did art came into play of this nation building subject, mm-hmm. and what it has to do with work on a very material life basis. So that's very important, and I think like it doesn't come I mean, of course it comes when you talk about sound. I think sound as a medium, or like as a form of mediation or relation, complicates things very differently than image producing, for example. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you find this in every, you can find like, and I think it's also very specific that we immediately came to disalienation as a term, because you can find this through like, and it's a term maybe good to say, which is very shaped by Frantz Fanon,
yes,
as like a decolonial practice.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, which Frantz Fanon said, this is the only horizon, which is the liberating horizon of the white and the black subject. Mm-hmm. And thinking like about disalienation as the horizon of our practice, and also about disalienation as the horizon of our forms of education we want to use, just shapes our practice very instantly. And then it may be, I mean, it will be harder and harder to do that in the institutions at the point we're at right now. So to think about how we want to establish this in our art practice and integrate it in a social context is probably a very necessary and interesting one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a lot of fun kind of following along, because like, I feel like one sort of way for me to frame how I'm listening to this conversation is like my relationship to this institution and this space, because I was a music major here five, 6 years ago, and now I'm most active in very DIY, like underground experimental spaces, and like I've like kind of found like an ethos and like of abundance in those spaces, which is sort of, there's this undercurrent of scarcity because we don't have money, so
mm-hmm.
in some way, not entirely, it becomes that it's not about money in some way. Sometimes, ideally. And I think usually that enables like a sort of feeling of abundance, like you can play anything, you can
mm-hmm.
yeah, really play anything in any space, any sound system, mm-hmm. and like and I think there's something really liberating there. And I think where I am currently is like, as I'm trying to extract my financial independence from food service, I'm like, oh, is there money in like creating, you know, like, so I label like a sound artist, which like
mm-hmm.
I'm like kind of like, that feels kind of accurate. I like just saying that I do things with sound because that feels more honest.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, my like relationship around institutions and money, I think I'm like trying to not have such a binary, like, antagonistic relationship to it. And another thought I had was, like, how I think finding this sort of more, like, DIY ethos around sound, one way that it's inspired me as well as starting to field record is feeling like you can be immensely creative just by how you listen in like any space, like really any space ever. I find one of the most disorienting things is to listen in a crowded room, like say before a concert, before an event, for anything, just like, just try to catch, it's almost like listening to water, you know, but like it's more disorienting because you actually want to like hone in and trace the voice. But yeah, I just felt like there was so much coming up like in this conversation. I really enjoyed listening to it.
Thank you.
are listening to It's Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily